paperwork reduction. It has helped local schools be able to make management decisions. Again, I want to remind you that the federal government is one of the areas where we have the biggest problem with paperwork, and we need to work with them aggressively to get a reduction of that paperwork. We collect data at the Oregon Department of Education in large, voluminous amounts to send on to the U.S. government. I went back to the U.S. Department of Education, not winning great friends, several months after I was in office, and began asking what they did with the various paperwork we send them. You can't get out of the U.S. government today current real-time data to use in making education decisions. It's 4 years old. We have to change that system, and we can, and we will, and we are.
Dan, can you provide us with the number of forms or items that you request from the local school districts from just your agency?
Yes, we can, but we can't today. I'll tell you that the superintendent of Nebraska took all those forms in Nebraska and put them across the wall and had halls and halls full of it.
Well, I'm interested in what we require from Oregon.
Yeah.
To our local school district, because you know I've heard from our local districts and our local teachers, and they're overwhelmed with the amount of paper that they're asked to process.
Yes, we will do that.
I think if we can get a handle just on what we do here, that absolutely is required.
We will, and we'll tag which of those the U.S. government requires.
Thank you.
Mr. Bunn, could you give us an estimate on how long it would take you to come up with the information for Representative Winter's request?
Well, what I'd like to have to do that is several days, if we could. You're going to be sort of debating and working with these issues over, I think, a period of a week. All the other requests you've made we'll plan on having by the end of the day, but that one we'd like
could
to have several days.
Could we expect this then by the end of the week?
Yes.
Thank
yes.
you. Representative Winters, did you...
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Superintendent, regarding the grant application process that our local schools apply to the DOE for grants, as you can imagine, I've been talking to my local school districts a lot about this. One of the first cuts they have made is they will not apply for grants to DOE because it's too expensive. Why is that?
Well, I can tell you this, that the vast majority of our money for grants comes from the federal government. And we are, as are other states throughout the country, the administrator of those federal grants. And the guidelines that we develop are the guidelines that the federal government requires. For example, in the Carl Perkins area for funds for vocational technical education, you have to go through a significant series of things to get those funds. But those are items absolutely required by the federal government. We add little to no additional requirements beyond what the federal government requires. But what we can do, and I've already described it, don't need to go into more detail, is constantly push back on the federal government for ease of work in doing that. There's a great deal of difference in how things can be done, and it needs to be done in as streamlined a way as possible.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up, just an addition. Yes, if we could encourage the federal government, to me it's a very sad state of affairs that they can't afford to apply for the grants that supposedly free money. It's a very difficult situation.
I can assure you that in most grant situations, we have schools very enthused about applying for money and very, very excited about being there, receiving that money, and work with us and as full partners in getting that done.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent and perhaps also our LFO office, one of the concerns I have in looking at your 2% cuts, for example, is the Data Integrity Assurance Project. You have a $3.9 million on the first page, and then it returns a couple of the other times. So we don't get a real sense of, are we eliminating this? Are we reducing it by a quarter or a half or what? And if your documentation that you produce subsequent to this could include that kind of information, what's our 3.9 of what would help.
Madam Chair and Representative March, that's an excellent point, and we will attempt to compile the totals for you so that you have those. It's a 10.325 million cut. It basically cuts the heart out of the Data Integrity Assurance Program, an absolutely important program. But I remind you that the decision we had to make is, do we talk about that or the hospital cuts, the regional programs for kids, and that's the kind of thing we're...
Thank you.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Superintendent, the question I have is, how much money is in your budget for the implementation of the CAM program and its total?
While the promise in 1991 of legislative effort was that there would be strong funding for the SIM and CAM, that never materialized. And so basically the effort at higher standards for students has, we have been required to align that effort with other work. And so that, for example, in our reading effort, in our CAM effort, those are aligned where we find dollars, where we can do two things at the same time. So there was no, $200,000, I think, was appropriated by the legislature for that work.
So there's only $200,000 to implement the CAM.
Well, we have used...
The department's only spending $200,000 or $200,000 to...
No. If you ask the question, how much money are we spending on children for any program, for reading, for example, we spend not only the reading dollars, but other dollars as well. So what the legislature gave us was $200,000. But on the other hand, do you count the TESA work, the computerized assessment effort around writing, reading, those efforts that have brought reading from 52% to 82% for third graders, is that counted as CAM and SIM work, or is that counting as testing work? So everything we are doing recognizes that we want higher standards for students, but in terms of dollars the legislature gave for those, it was in discrete programs that we have bundled together to reach those higher standards.
One follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Could the department put its hands on the cost to local districts to implement the CAM project?
The legislature asked throughout the last session, the session before that, is asking now, what's the cost to schools of SIM CAM? We want to know that. We want to know what's there to cut. That's asking the question, what's the cost of embarking on higher standards for students? And the cost of that is cut, totaled, and developed depending on what you want to count. Do you want to count the reading program, the major reading initiative we've made? I would count that or not count it, but it's a part of that effort. There is no way to create a discrete out of the $280 million. Here are the specific dollars that go to this. It's as I described with the TESA program. But the legislature gave $200,000 to it.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Superintendent, the exchange that you just had with my colleague, Representative March, caused me to want to come up out of the detail a little bit and ask a higher-level question. With a $720 million shortfall right now and counting, and education representing 42% of the total budget, if cuts end up being proportion, you're in line for a $300 million cut. What does that do to your program?
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I would ask if we could to defer that to Nancy Heiligman's discussion with you on the school fund. It'll give you a very clear picture of that. But it has, I believe, devastating impacts. If you'd like to have that answered now, we can begin that
Thank you.
Process.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman, Associate Superintendent, Office of School Finance at the Department of Education. I will refer you to a handout that you have on the State School Fund. If you can turn to the first yellow page in the packet. At the governor's request, the Department of Education, working with the Quality Education Commission, has put together program impact statements using the quality education model. And you'll recall that the model is based on prototype schools in elementary, middle, and high school. And what we've presented to you is four different impact scenarios, and have tried to demonstrate the impact of 2% reductions at various levels on these prototype schools. Looking at scenario number one, and I should mention a couple of things also, that we're assuming that these cuts would be made in the second year of the biennium, in the 02-03 school year. And we've also, for each scenario, assumed that there will be a $60 million shortfall in local revenues since the original quality ed model recommendation came out. The initial $30 million reduction happened at near the end of the session as local property taxes and common school funds were expected to drop. Since then, there's an additional anticipated $30 million reduction in local property taxes. We expect to have even better information on local property taxes by the end of December, once we have a better idea what property tax collections have been this fall. So again, turning to the first reduction scenario, this is a 2% reduction assumption, and we're assuming that the entire reduction comes from the school improvement fund, or the funds that were set aside to focus on K-5 literacy. This would eliminate the school improvement fund in the second year of the biennium. And in each of these scenarios, we list our assumptions. We give examples of program impacts. And we're realizing that this is a prototype or kind of an average school, but that in each school district, each district would make local decisions about budget reductions, and they would have different impacts in each school. But what we're trying to show you is an example. And in this case, the resources to focus on K-5 literacy would be eliminated. Central service reductions would reduce support to schools, and we'd expect that facilities maintenance would be deferred. The expectations then would also change, and we'd expect that the number of students reaching benchmarks would continue to grow, but more slowly than we've seen over the past decade. The goal with the advent of the School Improvement Fund was that 90% of our elementary students would reach the benchmarks within 4 years. Elimination of the school fund would reduce that to prior forecast levels, which estimated that 90% of our third graders would reach those benchmarks by 2009, and that fifth graders would reach them at a later date. And just to illustrate how this spreadsheet works, you see some of the major components in an elementary school of 340 students. The first column is the baseline, which is really the current service level at the end of the last biennium. The approved budget, the legislatively approved budget, which increased resources to elementary schools to support reading. And then a 2% reduction would basically move those schools back to where they were at the in the last biennium. In the second scenario, I won't run through each of these in detail, but the second scenario was kind of a a different assumption, and that was that the school improvement fund would be left intact, that the focus on literacy would remain with those resources in place in the elementary school, and then that the entire 2% reduction was in the middle and high schools. You can see in the baseline, again, was basically where sort of a typical Oregon middle school was at the end of the last biennium. The approved budget was actually shows an example of a reduction in the secondary, because you may recall that to fund the school improvement fund, the state eliminated $110 million from the state school fund and matched that with an additional $110 million. So the assumption was that if those funds came out of what may have come out of secondary schools and were shifted to elementary. So in the approved budget, you do see a reduction in staffing in the middle school, and then a further 2% reduction we're assuming would eliminate additional staffing at in the electives. And then what I'll do is, well, moving to the third scenario, is a 4% reduction assumption. This one eliminates the school improvement fund at the elementary level and assumes across-the-board cuts in elementary, middle, and high school. Still assumes the reductions in central and in administrative costs. And what I think I'll do, because of the press of time, we'll just move to the fourth scenario, which is the blue sheet. If you turn to the very back, this shows a 4% reduction at a prototype high school. This is a high school assumed to have 1,000 students. Assumes that the first 2% reduction comes from secondary schools, and then the second 2%, there are across-the-board cuts in elementary, middle, and high schools. Again, the central reductions. And what you see is that a 4% cut under this scenario would eliminate all elective courses in high school under this example. It would raise class size to an average of 28 students per classroom. It would begin to cut into staffing for core courses in high schools. It would eliminate all counseling staff. It would eliminate two FTE classified support staff, eliminate textbooks, supplies, and materials funding, about $20 per student, and would include an additional reduction in operations and maintenance to a 10% level. The program impacts would, we'd assume that counseling functions would not totally be eliminated, but would be shifted to teachers, and further reducing instructional time. CAM implementation would be delayed. Central service cuts would increase time support staff had to work on paperwork and other items. Facilities maintenance would be deferred. Expectations, we would expect that the numbers of students that are currently reaching benchmarks would stay the same or begin to decline. And we would also very much expect that dropout rates would increase. Again, this is an example based on a prototype school. Believe that some schools, particularly small schools, would probably the cuts would have larger impacts, or in districts with declining enrollment, you'd probably see greater impacts than this at this reduction level. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
In the interest of keeping on to the schedule, we have only got 5 more minutes before we're scheduled to change over to the next presentation. Representative Butler and Representative Nolan have asked a question, and if you can move it right along here, we can accommodate you.
I just have one quick question relative to page 2 of the blue sheets there. The average class size with a 4% reduction going from 24 to 28 students. That's plus 4 students from the baseline to the 28 students. That's a 16% increase in class size. That's where we're anticipating growth in the students, even with the dropout rate that we're experiencing.
That's how we're going to solve the problem.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Butler, based on our calculations in the quality education model, we do believe that the average class size would move to 28. We would expect some of the classes would be smaller and some would be larger. The calculations are based on the number of students. If we eliminate one teacher, that eliminates 6 courses, and it's just a simple mathematical calculation that we use based on the number of students.
So it isn't a 16% reduction or increase in class size based upon student population, it's just the number of classes that there are.
Yes, it's based on the number of classes that would be available, and then those students who weren't in those classes would have to shift to other.
And that also takes into consideration the 25% dropout rate that we've got in high schools right now in Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, it takes into account current dropout rates. It doesn't take into account increases in the dropout rate, although we expect that some of those some students who are in school would drop out.
Thank you.
But we didn't include that.
Representative Nova.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nancy, I take it from the information you've presented that you've given us the impact of up to a 4% reduction in the Common School Fund and have not attempted here to project the impact of up to a 10% cut. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, we were asked by the governor's office to prepare up to a 6% cut, and these scenarios, because some of them are mutually exclusive, would give you a 6% reduction if you, for example, eliminated the school improvement fund, cut an additional 2% out of secondary schools, and then did an across-the-board cut. All of those reductions would add up to a 6% cut. So we have provided you information that would provide, if you sort of mix and match the scenarios, you could make a 6% cut.
You did everything on these sheets.
That's correct.
That would add up to about 6%. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Winters.
Thank you. Just a quick question, and you can provide this information to us later, but there's been a lot of figures that have been bannered about it as to what is the dropout rate. Could you provide us with the dropout rate statistics, please, so that we have a more accurate picture of what really the situation is in Oregon? And also, it would be helpful in looking at the QE model key components if you have the other category that said what existed before the last budget cycle, so that we can look at what these components, and I recognize that all the components weren't in play before the last budget cycle, but it gives this panel, those of who were not on budget, what we actually allocated in 99-01 and what happened in 01-03.
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, we can do that. I can tell you that the dropout rate that we reported last spring was 6.3%, or 10,600 of our high school students dropping out. We do expect that to have decreased slightly over the past year, and will be releasing those numbers later this winter. Is that the information?
No, I guess it would be helpful because there's some areas in our state that actually experience much higher than the 6%. You know, there, and I think as you're looking at budget rebalancing, I think you're looking at the whole issue of, you know, I call it, we get to the place where we're talking need versus our wishes and our desires. And so, you know, at some point, I think this body needs to look, have a good perspective and a good overview of what's going on in our state with respect to our students. And certainly there are areas where, you know, it's much higher than 6%.
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, are you asking then for our dropout rates by school?
That would help.
We can do that.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that in your first part of your presentation, in the early childhood cuts, you talk about increased litigation under due process as a possibility for those upper two tiers of cuts. Are there other possibilities that the state would be sued under some of the scenarios that you present to us, say, for equalization, since you mentioned that the impact on some declining enrollment districts might be a disparate impact under some of these scenarios? Other kinds of litigation where kids not being equally served might be?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we do believe that's a very real possibility. Look at reductions that would severely impact the basic programs in our schools.
Madam Chair, if I might also add to that, we believe as a part of this budget effort, we will be required to much more aggressively attempt to align federal funding with state program efforts. That will expose the Department of Education, the legislature, to dangers in audit reviews. And we're frankly asking you to be partners in that risk-taking. It's one of the things that if we make these decisions will likely occur.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to come to us today, and I appreciate the time you took to prepare the testimony, and I also appreciate the time you will take to get the articles that we asked you to submit to us. So, again, my thanks. I'll call forward now the Oregon University System.
I'm trying to hold the side up as hard as I can. Okay, you gotta get these $200
chairs.
We need to take turns.
Something I said or did, I said. I did, it doubled up even.
Oh, here, now you're
got reinforcement.
Carolyn, anything at all.
Yeah.
Here.
Looking for the remainder of my small group.
There we go. So are we.
I know you're ready.
Yeah.
No, nothing. No.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joe Cox, Chancellor of the Oregon University System, at least for a while longer anyway. And with me is Tom Andrus, who is my Vice Chancellor for Administration and Finance. And we also have in the room several other members who have more detailed knowledge about specific areas that you may want to have questions about. And I'd like to, on the basis of instruction from your staff, do two things. One, in about 12 minutes or so, do an overview of the work that we've done for the governor in this first step of this three-act opera that we're all engaged in, and then after that, turn to questions, reform with the committee, if that's your pattern. I wasn't able to hear the opening for Superintendent Bunn, so I don't know quite how you proceeded, but if that's acceptable.
That would work just fine. Let's proceed on that.
Thank
process.
You. But begin by making about five overview comments. That the university system is not in a recession. We're experiencing the greatest boom in the system's 70-year history. We've never had more Oregonians enrolled than we do at the moment. We broke all records this fall, some 71,000 plus students. There is nothing surprising about this. To me, higher education is the surest path to long-term economic stability and advancement for most people. And clearly, these students understand that the 21st century is a knowledge-driven economy. Oregon's economic progress will depend upon increasing the production of prepared, employable graduates and depend upon the generation of new intellectual property and new inventions to fuel this new economy of ours. The economy is much more diverse than it was two decades ago, fortunately for all of us. And the budget cuts in the board's submission to the governor recognize all of these facts and try and protect instruction and core mission as much as possible. What I'd like to do is to take you through some of the material that we've given you very briefly and talk about the exercise that we have been through and in fact are still very much engaged in. And it came out of a series of meetings between the governor and the members of the State Board of Higher Education, most particularly a session in Klamath Falls, where agreement was reached upon the direction that would be given us. And I think that we have tried do two things. One, in about 12 minutes or so, do an overview of the work that we've done for the governor in this first step of this three-act opera that we're all engaged in. And then after that, turn to questions, reform with the committee if that's your pattern. I wasn't able to hear the opening for Superintendent Bunn, so I don't know quite how you proceeded, but if that's acceptable.
That would work just fine. Let's proceed on that.
Thank you.
That would work just fine.
But begin by making about five overview comments. That the university system is not in a recession. We're experiencing the greatest boom in the system's 70-year history. We've never had more Oregonians enrolled than we do at the moment. We broke all records this fall. Some 71,000 plus students. There's nothing surprising about this. To me, higher education is the surest path to long-term economic stability and advancement for most people. And clearly, these students understand that the 21st century is a knowledge-driven economy. Oregon's economic progress will depend upon increasing the production of prepared, employable graduates and depend upon the generation of new intellectual property and new inventions to fuel this new economy of ours. The economy is much more diverse than it was two decades ago, fortunately for all of us. And the budget cuts in the board's submission to the governor recognize all of these facts. Try and protect instruction and core mission as much as possible. What I'd like to do is to take you through some of the material that we've given you very briefly and talk about the exercise that we have been through and in fact are still very much engaged in. And it came out of a series of meetings between the governor and the members of the State Board of Higher Education, most particularly a session in Klamath Falls, where agreement was reached on the direction that would be given us. And I think that we have tried our very best to follow that direction throughout this process. The governor and the board agreed at the start that we would attempt to protect at all costs the instructional core component that we would then try to protect our public service and research missions as well, but that instruction was to be the core. Secondly, that we would do everything we could to maintain access for Oregonians while still not being able to fully support demand, but to try and not withdraw on some of the access initiatives that we have launched over the last 10 years. Fourthly, we were not to go across the board. This is in page one of the of the handout that you have. We were not to go across the board.
Handout that you have.
A corollary to that, we were not to turn to tuition increases.
We were not to turn to
as a right out of the box answer to everything.
As a right out.
And we have not done that.
And we have not done that.
We were to do everything we could to limit the impact, negative impacts on quality. We were to do everything we could to support our moves toward greater university autonomy within the general range of the board's priorities. And that we should remain committed to community and statewide economic development initiatives and opportunities. On the next page, page two, we carry that down one more level in terms of the instructions that were given us by the governor and by the board. We were to place our emphasis on resident Oregon undergraduate students as our top priority. That meant that we would be limiting further non-resident subsidies. It also meant that we would focus on administrative reductions. And that we would, by protecting instruction, we would be required to direct much of our attention in terms of reduction to the non-instructionally driven targeted investment side of our budget, which Tom Andrus will get into in just a moment. We were not to back away from the new initiatives that you approved last session. We might have to scale them back, but we were not to back away from the engineering initiative. We were not to just defer all the new things that you approved our doing. We were not to back away from the small school stabilization because of the importance of that to the four smaller institutions. We were not to back away totally from the CIA, from the support for the institution, the expansion in Central Oregon. Neat trick. If you can do all of this, my announced retirement had preceded this, so I cannot show you any degree of direct connection, but it is a challenge, and I think I can tell you without hesitation that the universities have stepped up. This has not been easy. Obviously, it's not fun. It's quite painful for them. But I believe that they have stepped up and attempted to bring their best thinking to this. On page three, just to refresh the memories of those who weren't on education sub of ways and means, this is where we came out of the session, and so this is the basis that we start from. We start from the 808 number. Which already represented a $23 million reduction in general fund support for instruction, but we were allowed to make that up with tuition. So that's the picture that we came out of the session. As I said in my opening remarks, we are up in enrollment in headcount, we're up in FTE, and that's good news. It also challenges us to be up with that kind of increased demand in a time of declining and strained resource. Page 5 is simply to make the point that the goal we set in the 99 session of getting our funding for instruction and for the institutions to about the median of our peers nationally, about the 50th percentile, we came out of the 99 session at about 44th, and we continue to lose ground, as you see, through the various reduction scenarios at 6%, at 8%, at 10%. And the only point of that is to show you that as we increase demand as is occurring, we only further dilute the support for instruction as a result. Number six is a summary that will not surprise you in narrative terms of the impacts on services to students. The board was pressed us hard on this. The board demanded quantification for our answers. We attempted to provide that, but there is no question that does happen. What I'd like to do now, if I can, is have Tom take us through briefly page seven. Perhaps we should ask, were there questions at this, point? Enrollment is up.
Perhaps if the committee could hold their questions until the entire presentation is over, that might expedite things. So please go ahead.
What I'd like to ask Tom to do with page 7 in the handout is to display for you the two sides of our budget approach. On the left-hand side is instruction, pure and simple, and that's what we were asked to protect throughout the exercise, although, as you'll see, there are reductions from the 2% level on. Over on the right-hand side of the page are targeted programs from the word targeted investments, which is what you styled the investments as you made them. So on the left-hand side is pure instruction. On the right-hand side are the targeted investments. And I'll point out that in the targeted investments, there are instructional components. The engineering component, of course, the Cascades campus. But we were asked by our board and by the governor to segment pure instruction from the rest of our budget. Tom, if you would take us through that and the next several.
Thank you. Tom Andrews, the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration at the Oregon University System. Actually, I think the Chancellor has pretty well summed it up. I think when you look at what we were trying to do, given the basic guiding point, we were going to protect instruction and instructional support, you then have to look at those areas that are not enrollment-driven. So those targeted programs that you see on the right hand is really where we got the initial focus and put the primary emphasis. And again, in the broadest sense, you've got our research programming, our state funds for research, the statewide public services programming. That includes your ag experiment, your cooperative extension, and the forestry research lab. Collaborative programs, primarily with community colleges, OHSU, and so on down the line. Centralized services, there's a variety of various programs that are provided through that, including the Chancellor's Office. The Chancellor's mentioned the small school allocation. Engineering, you can see, is a major component. And it's worth emphasizing on the engineering that part of that is for providing instruction. It's not provided through the model, per se, or through on the instructional side, but nonetheless, it is a major initiative that deals with growth in students and numbers of faculty that relate to that. So what you then see, bottom line, is there's about $290 million that we were really putting the initial focus on gaining the largest reductions early on, 2.6%, those were where we looked first to avoid reductions to instruction. Just as a matter of percentages on page 8, you can see, generally speaking, where, again, the percentages are. You can see instruction, undergraduate and graduates represents 65%, as mentioned earlier. So looking, as we get into the 8 and 10% reduction scenarios, you'll see that they are really very heavily hit at those levels. But earlier on in the process is where we had the focus on the targeted programs. I think we could probably go now to page 10. This is simply kind of the outcome by institution at each of the increments, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10%. This is kind of the product of the planning. As an example, you can see at the top, Eastern Oregon University got a dollar reduction at 2%, 4%, growing up to 10%. You have the actual dollars that they would have. Again, gives you a sense, and the percent reduction was important for us because we did look at that very closely as we looked at the impact on each university. There are obviously differences as we go through this, depending on the programs that are reduced. That became an important benchmark for us to consider. Page 11. This is really taking those percentage reductions and just laying them out separately. And you can go through and see Eastern, OIT, and so forth. The emphasis, if you'll notice, on the Oregon State University, OSU, with statewide public services, you will see that they are reduced at a higher level, as are central services down at the last line. Once we made the decisions in terms of statewide public programs, which you'll notice a little bit later, were reduced at a higher level, particularly early on, therefore that institution realized is a larger reduction. And one of the focuses for us was also on centralized services. That includes the Chancellor's Office, where we realized reductions, larger reductions, had to be taken in those areas as well because of the not connected to instruction as directly. And finally, on page 12, this is a list of programs. And you have a separate sheet of paper that was handed out with this. that handed out
basically defines each one of these.
That basically defines
as an example, Western W.
As an example,
do you have that one?
Western okay. W. You have that one?
This is a list of programs that have variable impacts on each of the universities.
That have variable
we went through these programs and. In a very programmatic sense, tried to look at them and isolate where we could make reductions. Again, going back to the concept of where would the largest reductions be relative to the principles of trying to support instruction. At the top, the top two lines, undergraduate and graduate. That is, again, what the chancellor had mentioned relating to instruction. This is the students. This is all of your academic instructional support programs. As you can see, at the 2% and 4% levels, we are not making any revenue reductions. There actually may be some very minor reductions in terms of expenditures, but at 2% and 4%, what we're trying to say, we do not want to reduce to any measurable degree student access. We then move into 6%, 8%, and 10%, as we do that, it grows. And it grows because the options that we have on the administrative side or on the targeted programs, we've already really gone through those pretty much at 2, 4, and 6. So instruction and the amount of dollars that we're looking at diminishes. What you should remember also, because I think in terms of magnitude, it's one thing to talk about the percentages. When we're looking at the undergraduate and the graduate reductions, and we're looking at them as an example at the 8% level, that is approximately $20 million. So out of what is at 8% for us, which would be $64 million reduction, $20 million would come out of instruction. And at 10%, you're looking at over $30 million reduction out of the $80 million. So again, it's proportionately growing. It's assuming more and more of the burden at instruction. Again, we wanted to avoid that. Highlighting some areas where there are some more significant dollars, and one that I think most everybody is aware of, is the statewide public services. And you can see that down in about the mid page, where we show at 2%. That's a 4.75% reduction. That's approximately $5 million reduction on a $100 million base. Statewide public services, and that's your ag experiment co-op extension, forestry research lab. It's about $102 million. And then 10% reduction, or about $10 million at 4 and so on up. Again, why at that level? Not because we don't like those programs. They are valuable. They are extremely important. But we needed and we felt that it was critical to identify targeted programs that were not providing direct instruction for credit programs. And obviously the statewide programs, as over 12% of our budget, was going to be an early area.
I think it's a good place to point it out. On that same page, again, to make the point that we tried to preserve the new targeted investments that you approved are doing, this, you can see that at 2% and 4%, in some cases 6%, we attempted to protect the small school initiative, we attempted to protect engineering, even at the worst case. On this chart, 10%, we will still be making a significant new investment in engineering. In other words, we have taken quite literally the direction from our board and the Engineering Technology Industry Council and your wishes, and we've tried to ensure that we protected as long as we could those targeted new initiatives. The other one that I would point to is the Cascade campus. It was not called Cascades when the legislature was acting upon it, but that's what it has since become. And you can see that we protected that up through the 4%. At 6%, it gets hit.
38%.
At what?
At 6%, the reduction is a 38% loss.
The reduction is a 38%.
So again, we were attempting to abide by the direction from the governor and our board that we not just back out from the governor and those new initiatives, but try to stay faithful to them as long as we could, as much as we could.
As long as we could, as much as we could.
Representative Smith had a question, I think.
Well, I think that I will just hold questions until you finish your presentation.
Well, we're almost through that. Tom, if you want to do quickly the next couple pages, then I will stop.
Actually, I think that pretty well highlights it. I would say the page 13 is really just a recasting of what we saw on page 10, implications based on cell value targeted program that not that significant. The last 12 or 13 pages then give you a narrative impact of the reductions at each level.
Thank you.
That's all.
Thank you very much. I do have a couple of questions that I would like to ask. First off, one of them is, with the statewides, there's actually two line items here that deal with statewides. One deals with building maintenance, and one deals with actually cutting the services. Can you discuss what the building maintenance line item is all about?
Tom, can you differentiate between the two?
Yes. This is Tom Andrews again. The statewides is actually identified as different. I want to say different, not revenue sources.
Where's Steve?
I want to say different, not revenue
sources.
You've
got the segregation of the public service,
the facilities component is
separated from the statewide
operating.
The operating component. I don't know it.
Whether that's for historical reasons?
Well, yeah, that's. I mean, I know those are
historical reasons. My understanding, Madam Chair, members, is that historically, prior to higher ed's new budget model, the operations of the statewide public services were appropriated as separate line items to the university system, and the actual cost of maintaining those buildings at Oregon State, where these facilities are located, came from their general education and general appropriation. So this particular item funds the cost of operating the facilities where the statewide public services are located, which are actually funded out of the ENG, what we call the ENG budget, as opposed to the separate appropriations for the statewide operation.
Yeah, that's that differentiation.
So then, would you think it would be fair to characterize the cuts to the statewide as a combination of these two line items? The second more of a comment that I have, I'm going back to your page one of your presentation where you're talking about the core mission of the system being instruction, research, and public service. And coming from one of the rural areas of the state where the ag research and the forestry research and the extension outreach that the statewide programs encompass, those are, I think, in terms of the core mission of the system, three things that the statewides embody, that for the ag, the areas of the economy for the state in general, that agriculture occupies and that forestry occupies, certainly the statewides are the source of research into problems that are trying to be solved, diseases, new crop development, new practices, agriculture and forestry practices. They're also the process whereby that information is disseminated to people and they're instructed in the best use of it. And I have very grave misgivings about the size of cuts to these type of programs in light of the impact that they're going to have on some of the areas of the economy that we're looking to pull us out of the place that we find ourselves in right now. And quite frankly, I find it rather disingenuous of the system to be proposing such strong cutbacks in these kinds of programs, which are the kinds of things that help me our timber industry partners and our agricultural partners competitive in the markets that they're facing today. And this is one area that I intend to put a lot of energy into. I'm very frustrated by what you're proposing here. I'm very
frustrated. Chair Morgan, members of the committee, in defense, I would just say that we attempted to respond to the directions, the very clear directions that we were given by the executive branch and our board. And so we were not free agents in deciding what priorities would be. That's not an excuse. That's simply a statement of the assignment we were given. I would call your attention to page 7 again in the initial
seven again.
Wrong page. Forgive me, wrong page. I'm looking for the page, Tom, which...
Forgive me, wrong page. I'm looking for the page, Tom.
Yes, I'm sorry. Page seven.
Yes, I'm sorry. Page seven.
$290 million in the various targeted programs of which the statewides are part of. Statewides are fully one-third of that whole part of the budget. And will remain even at worst case. And I don't know where this will all come out. But even at worst case, I believe that our investments, the state general fund investment in the statewide, will still exceed $95 million, which will remain more than a third of the total. So relatively, they are still a significant, huge part. And I don't dispute at all. I come from the part of Oregon where I know how important they are. Not arguing. I'm simply trying to clarify its relationship within the budget and the charge we were given.
I have a further question on the OSU Cascades campus. Of the $7 million that was allotted in the budget to be spent on that line item, can you talk to the committee about how much of that has been spent to date, where the expenditures are in that?
I think Mr. Andrews probably has more chapter and verse than I, but I will say that the Board of Higher Education, as part of this larger effort, has pulled back some of that funding from Cascades to hold for a bit until we see where this process all comes out. I remain personally very committed to making that initiative happen, if at all possible. I do know that the $7.5 million was a scaled-down number from where everything started. If you get much below a certain minimal level, you'll probably challenge whether it can be done. I would suspect that over $5 million of that, in terms of commitments, both for we're committed to a 20-year contract on a facility, where we are leasing from COCC, OSU has made contract commitments to some staff and faculty. I think if Tim White, provost at OSU, were here, he would tell you that at least $5 million of that is probably committed, or if you stopped it tomorrow, you would not get those funds back for at least probably 2 years until the contract would be honored. $5 million, that's my guess. Tom could disagree.
I won't disagree, sir. It's $5.4 million is what we're seeing as right now as committed.
We challenged it pretty hard.
And there is, what the board has done is set aside $1.8 million. Not that one point at some portion of it couldn't go back to Cascades. But there was a concern at that point in time about what the level of support should be relative to the other programs that we have, but with a process that within the board they'll review and provide funds back to either Cascades or other programs. I think, as the Chancellor said, much of this is lease cost. You have a number of administrative systems, registrar-type startup costs, and again, there's a large majority of that is committed.
If I might ask the department to provide to the committee a definitive list of what those commitments are, how much they are, and what the nature of the commitments are.
By nature, is it a contract? Do you mean, is it a contract, or
by nature, is it a
purchase already made, or
I want to know where in levels of commitments those things are in terms of being able to come back.
I think OSU can provide that.
And what kind of time frame would you need to comply with that?
Within 2 days, we can provide that information.
Thank you.
We're back here tomorrow in front of the Senate. We might even be able to bring it back tomorrow.
The representative Smith, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Andrews, is the RAM fully funded?
No, it is not.
Has it ever been funded?
No, it has not. No.
Okay.
The high water mark was 88% of the average.
And what year was that last by?
99.
And what year was that last by? And these numbers are based upon actual dollars allocated by the legislature. Your whole budget package, everything in here. For instance, on page 12, you have a RAM reserve, and into the 10% cut as a minus 100%.
These are, to the best of our knowledge, based on actual allocations, based on the legislative budget, which is the one that's displayed on page
which is the one that's displayed on page three.
So I'm assuming that the RAM has not done you well in what you consider to be funding for the university system.
I would disagree. The RAM has worked well. It's our ability,
The
RAM has made the institutions more entrepreneurial. The RAM has brought a level of greater autonomy to the campuses.
Our problem has come with how well we've been able to fund. So maybe one could assume that the RAM funding model has initially been flawed.
No, with due respect, I don't believe it's flawed. I think we didn't have it right for the small school fund. We have a small school fund. And you dealt with that to try to bring some greater parity. When you're dealing with institutions that are 20,000 and those that are 4,000, creating a funding model that really works. But I think we've gotten closer to it. I do believe that it's had the effect of making the institutions both more accountable and more entrepreneurial.
Thank you very much.
More accountable and more entrepreneurial.
Representative Winters.
Thank you. I just have a Representative Winters. Just a quick question. As you were going through the process,
as you were going
did you look at what the dollar investment was? And I particularly, we heard a lot of testimony during committee hearings during the session of the need to invest in research dollars. And I want to get back to that. And yet, for every dollar that we invest in research, we get approximately $20 back in return. So, from a business side of it, I would think that that's very prudent that we continue those kinds of investments and they're on the list. What kind of discussion did you have respecting the list?
I think what came out of the initial, our first grant, was we went back after a lot of input. We went back.